have shared this before, but it's been a very private setting, because I've never publicly come out and said, gosh, here's what happened to me. And it's been several years, and hopefully I can get through it tonight without falling apart and sobbing. Usually it's quite emotional for me to talk about, but I think enough time has passed that I'll be able to get through it. Bob kind of gave me an outline to follow. He wanted to talk about my life before I had the accident, what happened in the accident, and then what experiences I had, near death, out of body, spiritual experiences, during or as a result of that. And then if there's been any gifts or anything that's happened because of that. So I'm going to kind of follow that outline. I'll just give you the brief rundown of who I am in my life. I grew up on a little farm in Charleston, which is, I laugh and say it's a suburb of Midway. It's up by Deer Creek Reservoir near Heber. And grew up there with my brothers on a dairy farm and worked very hard and had a lot of fun. And we were a rough and tumble bunch, me and my brothers. We were very athletic. Baseball was probably my first love, but then I became very keen to football. Loved playing football. And yet growing up in Heber, everybody knows where Heber is, wrestling was also a part of your repertoire. It's not a sport in Heber. Wrestling is a religion. So I was converted and baptized into the wrestling school of the Wasatch Valley there. So anyway, grew up happy. Grew up with a good life and with hard work and with brothers and parents and a lot of support. And ended up going to Utah State. Left the farm and went up to Utah State and walked on and got a football scholarship. So I was playing football at Utah State and enjoying that very much. And loved my body. I mean, I had a command of, you know, I was strong and healthy and didn't appreciate it at the time. You know, it's those of you who are young and healthy, boy, grasp that and love that and embrace your body. It's the greatest gift you'll probably ever be given. I went to school there and ended up leaving school for a couple of years to do a proselyting mission in Scotland. So I left the country and went over to the UK and spent some time there. And it was an interesting scenario because before I left, I had fallen madly in love with a girl who I ended up marrying eventually. But I left for 2 years, came back, and she had waited for me, and we got married and started a family, and I started my career, and everything was pretty much magic. It seemed that everything I did just was successful. It worked out. I was accelerating my career. I had worked at a lot of big ad agencies and was involved with big clients like Intel and United Way and 3M, and the accolades were coming, and gosh, I'd get a raise, I'd get a promotion, I'd move to another company, and they would recruit me, and I thought life was really good. You know, I hadn't had a lot of really hard tests or anything to go through. Had my first son, which is Spencer. He's the one in college. He just turned 20 last month. And then we had another little boy as well, which was an interesting story because we had a hard time getting number two there. We had to go and seek some medical help and go through the University of Utah's fertility center and get number two. So it was me and my wife and two boys. My oldest at the time was seven, and my youngest was just 14 months, just over a year old. We had taken a trip down to St. George. We were going down to see my wife's grandfather, who was in a convalescent center. He had Alzheimer's disease. And we wanted to go visit him for Easter. So it was an Easter break weekend, very close to this time of year, actually, that we had headed down. I visited him, and we'd had a nice visit. It was an interesting visit because we came to see him, and he didn't know who anybody was, but immediately he recognized us, even the grandchildren. He knew them. We embraced, we talked, we laughed, and got ready to come home. Packed up the car, headed out of town. And for whatever reason, and I don't remember the details of the accident, but we were heading northbound on I-15 near Parowan. The police report said there was heavy crosswinds. There was a report that there was a sporadic pickup truck that was cutting people off and driving crazy. I may have fallen asleep at the wheel. I don't know what happened, but for whatever reason, the car with the cruise control set at 75 miles an hour, I went off the road, overcorrected. And as I came on the road, the car proceeded to roll. Not off the road, but unfortunately down the road. So the hard concrete propelled the car, they say, probably rolled no less than 7 or 8 times. And finally came to a rest. All I remember of that was my wife screaming and me trying to control the car. And just knowing that I had lost control of the car. The next thing I remembered was coming to a stop or being in the car, and I knew I was in a great deal of pain. And I could hear my oldest son crying in the back seat. And I knew it was bad. There was something in my heart and in my soul that told me that my life was gone and that my baby son also was gone. And I remember sitting in that trauma, just heartbreaking, gasoline. I knew it was awful. And yet the last thing I remember is hearing sirens. So I knew somebody was coming. That's the last thing I remember. That's it. I was out, gone, and done, and that was it. Now at that point, as far as I could tell, I was on the floor underneath the steering wheel, consciously. That was my last recall. I was really banged up. Now I didn't know this at the time, but what had happened is my rib cage had been crushed, my lungs were collapsing, my back had been cracked in a couple of places. Both of my legs had been severely crushed and shattered. They had to amputate the left leg. And then my right shoulder had been torn out so severely that every muscle that basically held it in was torn out, and it had been severed to the point where doctors told me I would never use it again. And to make matters worse, the seatbelt had cut through me and ruptured my intestines. So in all those open wounds, all of me spilled out on myself. And so I had terrible infections. It was, I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be alive. And yet with those physical injuries, nothing was as traumatic as the bereavement, as knowing that half my family was gone. It was laying there, knowing I was badly hurt, knowing they were gone, and hoping my oldest son was okay in some way, that all of a sudden, I found my place, myself in a different place. Now, I didn't experience a tunnel or anything like that. It's just immediately I was in light. I was surrounded by complete peace and light, and there was no pain. I was completely whole, and I was completely conscious of myself and my surroundings, and everything else seemed to just fade away. In that setting, my wife came to me. She was there. She was physically there. She was tangible. We spoke. We embraced. And the odd thing about my experience is she was the one that was upset. She was sobbing, and she kept saying, "You can't be here. You can't stay. You can't come. You've got to go." As odd as it seems, in that scenario, I was comforting her. I was saying, "It's going to be okay." And she kept saying, "I know it's going to be okay, but you've got to go. You can't stay. You can't be here." Almost, you know, it wasn't a choice. It wasn't like you could choose to stay or go. She said, "You've got to go. You cannot come. You've got to get out." And the next thing I was conscious of was actually wandering a hospital. I didn't know where the hospital was. I didn't recognize anything about it. But I found myself very freely wandering this hospital. And that was one of the odd things about this, is travel was, I was here, I was there, I was, you know, there was nothing. It wasn't like I was walking around or flying around. I was just here and then there and then, you know, in different places. But the interesting thing about the hospital, which I would probably classify as a out-of-body experience more than a near-death experience, is I began realizing that people were unaware of my presence. They didn't know I was there. But I was very aware of them in a super-conscious way, I suppose. As I would walk the hallways and as I would encounter people, it's very difficult to explain, but I knew them perfectly. I knew their hate, I knew their love, I knew their joy, I knew their pain, I knew their motivation and everything they'd ever done. It was as if it was myself in them. I knew them perfectly. I would encounter them, and I knew them at such a level that I felt as if I loved them. I felt as if I knew them. I felt as if I was them. It was really almost a cosmic oneness scenario where I would encounter them, know them, understand them, love them, and then move on to the next one. And this went on for a while as I wandered this hospital until I finally encountered this poor man that I thought, "My gosh, look at this wreck, look at this mess," and then realized it was me. I was looking at my own body and knowing that I've got to get in there and get on with things. I don't know how I got in the body. That was not necessarily anything but a conscious thought. You know, I've got to get in the body. But the next thing I remember was pulling the ventilation tube out of my throat, the nurses rushing and trying to revive me and get the ventilator back into my mouth and revive me. Now, The hospital was an interesting experience. I was there for almost 6 months. I had 18 surgeries trying to patch me back together. I'm told that the first night of trauma, my dear mom's here, and she can probably help me. I don't recall, but there was like five surgeons working on me for 10 or 12 hours or something, and trying to patch me back together. I also, during the process, threw two pulmonary embolisms, which are blood clots that get lodged in your lungs. Now, those can be lethal in and of themselves, but I survived both of those, and those were on two different occasions. So it was everything that should have knocked me out and put me on the other side happened, and yet I did not die, except perhaps I did for a slight moment and then came back. The interesting thing about this experience is having been in that place, having been in that place of peace, in that place of, I don't even know how to explain it. That's what's so hard about talking to a group. How do I articulate what it felt like, what it looked like, what it was? But having been there, I would never forget it. Never forget what that was like, to feel that peace and to be there. It was interesting in the hospital because several months after, you know, after my surgeries, in fact, I was actually in the surgical rehabilitation area. I had, you know, family had been coming in, neighbors had been coming in, and I finally had this man and woman come in, and I didn't know who they were. And I thought, gosh, this is odd. You know, how do I greet them? Are they from the neighborhood, or is it a work associate? I didn't recognize who they were. And so I was a little self-conscious at first as they came in, but they said, we came in to see you. They said, we are your first surgical team. One was the ER doc, and the other one was one of the surgical nurses, and they were there when I was life-flighted in. And they said, how are you doing? And I said, gosh, I'm doing really quite well, but how gracious of you to come. I mean, you probably go through this every day, you know. It's very kind of you to come and check on me and see how I'm doing and ask the questions. And it was small talk and medical talk, and the doctor said, boy, I've never seen anyone with your injuries alive, let alone survive it. And then it was interesting because the nurse started getting emotional. She started to cry, and she said, we've come because we have to tell you what we experienced working on you. She proceeded to talk about how she was the first one into the receiving room as they life-flight someone in. In my best estimation, this is probably what was taking place as I was having the near-death experience, or when I was in that place of beauty and peace and being told I couldn't stay. But she said, as we brought you in, you seemed to be surrounded by light. You seemed to be surrounded by this glorious light. As she wept, and of course I started weeping, she said, I've never felt such love. And then she said, the interesting thing we encountered was your deceased wife was with you. We felt her, we saw her. And then the doctor spoke up from a clinical thing. He said, this doesn't happen very often, but I will verify she was there. And by this time, of course, I'm weeping. I've always believed in a life after, and I've always held that dear. In fact, that's probably the only thing that got me through this, was knowing there's a life after. But for me to have this experience with my deceased wife, and I'm almost self-conscious to say, get to say goodbye. I mean, how many people get to say goodbye and say it's okay? You know, I'll carry on and I'll leave and I understand I have to go. But I feel very grateful for that, very thankful. But to have other people experience a similar thing simultaneously while I was probably experiencing that and her communicating in some way why I had to be saved, was an interesting scenario, and I find it odd that multiple people were experiencing things, not just me. The other experience I want to share, which is interesting in and of itself, because it was months after the accident. I was still in the hospital. My surgeries were finished. They had patched up my arm. The only thing they hadn't done was fix my intestines. I was going to have to come back for that, so that I had a colostomy situation, and they were going to have to wait and wait till I was stronger to deal with that. But I was basically recovered. They had just finished the last surgery on my arm, and they had repaired all the muscles, and I was going through a series of shock treatment where they would put needles in there and probe. They would shock the nerves, trying to get them to regenerate into the muscles. But I was in a wheelchair. The amputation was complete. There was still some infection they were dealing with, but what I'm getting at is I wasn't on drugs anymore. Many could argue, oh gosh, you had a morphine-induced, you know, high of some kind, and that's what, you know, caused these experiences. Now, I know what I experienced, and morphine or not, it's very real to me. But at this point, I was not on painkillers anymore. You know, there was a very light dose of Lortab. I was recovering. I was due to go home in a matter of weeks. In fact, I think I was a week away from going home. I simply went to bed one night, went to sleep, peacefully went to sleep, And yet in that sleep, I found myself in that place again. And the reason I talk about having never, you know, never being able to forget that place, all of a sudden I thought, I'm in this place again, this place of light, this place of love, and moving freely. Now, you know, at the time I was amputated in a wheelchair, this leg was badly crushed. It still had 6 pins and a plate in it, just holding it together. So it was all bound up. Walking was not something I'd done for months. And here I was walking in this place of peace and light and beauty. And I just knew I'm back. I'm back in that place. And there's some odd details that, you know, Bob said, share the details. So I remember noticing architecture. This is strange, but I walked through a corridor and noticed the windows. And there was no panes of glass in the windows, and yet they seemed to be totally protective. I can't explain it, but I did notice architecture in this place. And yet down the corridor, as I walked, at the end of the corridor was a crib. And this was interesting, and I made my way to the crib. As I approached the crib, I looked in it and realized that was my son sleeping in the crib. If your fathers or mothers, I mean, the love you have for a child, I swept him up. I swept him up in my arms, and I'll never forget, it was super real. That's the only term I can use, is it was super real. I could feel every cell of his body against mine. He was warm. I could feel him breathing, and I recall feeling his soft head on my cheek, you know, holding him and just marveling that we were together, that he was there. And as I held him, I became engulfed in a presence. Someone came up behind me. And they were so magnificent. They were so, I don't have the words, but someone stood behind me. As I held my son, they spoke to me. And what they shared, I have never shared, and I probably will never share. I won't tell you tonight the details of what they said. It's just too personal. It's too sacred. But it's as if the whole universe opened and I understood everything. All of a sudden, everything made sense. There was no more questions. I mean, I had laid in that hospital bed for months, even with the experience saying, why? You know, why? Why both of them? Why now? Why is my body so busted? I'll never work right again. Why, you know, why? But that was all vanished. Everything was suddenly gone, and there was nothing but love, peace, and understanding. And when this experience, I wanted to turn around, but I thought, no, I can't. I'm not supposed to. I'm not supposed to encounter or embrace or look at this person. I just need to sit and feel this. And part of the understanding that came, and that's another thing I should try to articulate, and that's the hardest thing, is to articulate feelings. One of the things that came to me was about will, about our will, about our agency, our actions. At that point, I kind of was given a choice in some ways. Now, my son was dead and gone. I knew that, but here I was holding him. Here he was very much alive in my arms. But the figure, in my religious background, I'm quite confident it was Jesus Christ. I'm quite confident that's who it was. I know that's who it was, but I didn't turn around and look. I can't say, oh, he looked like this. But I knew what I felt. And basically, it came down sort of like, I don't want you to feel like this has been taken from you. I don't want you to begrudge this. I don't want you to feel like you've been dealt unfairly with. Therefore, I want to give you the opportunity to not have had your son taken from you, but I want to give you the opportunity to give him. To give him. In that place of understanding and peace, I kissed my boy's face and I laid him in the crib. And I woke up, you know, from this dream, I suppose. But it was not a dream. It was so super real that this life feels like the foggy, cloudy dream. That experience was intensified. It was super sensified. It was super sensory. I didn't just feel his body. I felt every cell. I felt the life in every cell. I felt the life of every cell of my own. And yet it was tangible. It was tangible. I could feel tangible, solid things. I felt the person behind me. The voice they spoke to me in it filled my entire soul. I didn't hear it with my ears. I felt it with my entire being. It was a different super sensory experience. And yet it gave me peace in some way. Now, was I Was I healed? Was I perfect? Did I come home and never cry again? No. I cried for a year. I'm crying now, even thinking about it. My oldest son, bless his heart, who was 7 at the time of the accident, he had spent time with my brother and sister-in-law, and he would come to the hospital and visit me. But gosh, he'd basically been orphaned for several months. I thought, how am I going to do this with him? How am I going to raise him? How am I going to explain to him how this is okay? How am I going to tell him what I've experienced? How am I going to ever replace a mother or a brother all of those things? And yet, somewhere in my heart would whisper this place I've been in, this peace. It said, choose joy. Choose happiness. Choose life. Choose love. And don't be bitter. Spencer is my oldest boy. He was funny. When I was coming home, I wondered, how will he accept me? I mean, I'm in a wheelchair. I have one leg. This right arm was still bound up. And I was a dad that would wrestle with him and throw the ball and run around on the lawn. And I thought, how's this going to be? I'm his only parent at this point. You know, if I go to school functions, how's he going to treat me? Will he be okay with this? And it was interesting when they brought me home. My brothers had come to the hospital to get me. And I actually lived with my younger brother for some time because I couldn't be on my own. I had to have, in-home nursing care. And I went to their home to have them help care for me. So they were very kind in doing that. But as my brothers brought me to his house and helped me get out of the car and put me in the wheelchair, the door swung open, and here came my son Spencer, and he came running out of the house, and I thought, oh, this is great, and he ran right past me, ran right past the wheelchair, and I thought, oh boy, he can't take it, I can barely take it. And yet he ran across the street, and he started knocking on all the neighbors' doors, and he was saying, come out, my dad's home. He says, you've got to come, you got to come meet my dad. You got to come see him. And he kind of ran around the circle and knocked on everybody's door. And then he ran and jumped up on my lap in the wheelchair, which at that, I got killed me. I mean, all the pain. And I said to him, are you okay, son? You do it. We going to be okay? And we still laugh about this. He said, Dad, he said, if you were nothing but a big puddle of blood, he said, I'd still love you. He was a great strength to me. It's interesting because he called me today. I'm not making this up. He called me today about 4 o'clock on the phone. He's up in Logan. And I was in a meeting, but when he calls, I try to take the call because he typically will text me. He wouldn't call me, he'd text me. But the phone was ringing, it was him, so I picked it up. I said, I'm in a meeting, son. Can I call you right back? And he said, well, yeah, but Addison, one of his best friends, he says, Addison found out his dad died this morning. And he said, he's really upset, and I don't know how to help him. And I won't get personal about people, but Addison's a kid that's kicked around the house. We've known him, and Addison's one of those guys that does not believe. There's nothing. He's in pre-med school. You're a biological organism, and when the heart stops, you're done, and that's it. It's over with. This is devastating to a young man who's lost his father unexpectedly. His father wasn't sick. There was nothing wrong. I don't know the details of what happened, but Spencer called and said, Addison's dad died, and I don't know how to help him. I don't know what to say. I don't know what comfort to give. I said, I'd you call some, because I've been preparing notes to talk about what we went through, to talk about what we experienced. I said, tell him that. Tell him that he'll get through it, that people will help him. But I said, you tell him that no matter what religion he is, no matter what religion anybody is, no matter what their belief system is, no matter what they think is true or not true, that there is a God in heaven, and that he loves him and cares about him, and that his dad is okay, that nobody's ever really gone. And I said, if he doesn't believe you, you have him call me, and I'll tell him I've been there, and I'll come back, and I'll help him through that somehow. But I thought it was interesting that he called and was trying to figure out how to give comfort. And I guess if there's anything I could do tonight, is that same thing. If anybody doubts the hereafter, I've brushed very close to it. I've been there. I've come back. And as far as I'm concerned, as far as what I know, as far as my experience, it's very real. It's far more real than this. This is the dreamy, weird place here. That is reality. That is what is true and right and good. Bob also asked me if I had received any gifts, if anything had happened, if having had these experiences, if I was different or if it changed my life. And it has. One of the tangible gifts I have is my closeness with my first son. My gosh, I mean, he 20 years old, I'm the first one he calls when he needs help or wants something or besides money, and in addition to money. But also, I've remarried. Tanya is my wife, and she's a gracious, spiritual, beautiful soul that kind of dropped into our family. That's a whole other night of how all that happened. We've adopted two beautiful boys who were going to come tonight, but they've been, tearing the place apart by now. So we let them stay home. But those have been gifts that have come into my life. Also, the interesting thing is I have no fear of death. I just have no fear of life either. It's like you live and it's like stepping from one room to the next. And it's a place of light and glory and love. So there's no fear there. I think I've also found myself to be more understanding or compassionate. This experience of wandering the hospital and encountering people for who they really, truly are was amazing. And I've tried to hold on to that, tried to reserve judgment, tried to realize who people are at their core instead of, what they look like or what they have on or even what they do sometimes. We're all probably much better on our inner selves than we are on our outer selves sometimes. I think I'm far more intuitive. Sometimes I will perceive people's thoughts. I'll know what they're thinking. The guys at work think it's funny. They'll say, gosh, you come in a meeting. How did you, They say, well, it's easy if you know what they're thinking. You can be thinking of the answers and you can address this thing over here. It doesn't happen all the time, but I'll perceive thoughts. I'll know what people are thinking. And so bless your heart over here. That's lovely. And shame on you over there. No, I'm just I'm joking about that. But I do have situations where you'll perceive, you'll have a knowing about someone. And it can be good, but it can also be a blessing and a curse. I've also found that people will, they'll just come to you and start spewing their inner feelings, their inner thoughts, their problems. And people at work have laughed about me being the psychiatrist because people just wander in my office and start spewing about all their personal problems. I'm like, I really didn't even ask and I really don't even want to know. So I become kind of guarded about that. You become kind of guarded when you know what people are thinking or if they come in and start sharing inner things and, you have to be compassionate. But I've had to really try to learn how to draw boundaries so I can manage that. And yet, even with all the experiences, I'm not perfect. I still get mad and spank the kids and make stupid mistakes and do bad things. And, so it hasn't transformed me into some being that's beyond human by any stretch of the imagination. But what I had was a very unhuman experience. It was a very spiritual experience. I think the one thing, if I could wrap this up in a nutshell so we can save time for questions and answers, it's the love. There's no better word than the love I felt, the love I experienced, and the love I know is there. I'm sure there's all kinds of different theologies about what happens after you die or where you go or what you do. But I think in the end, there's probably only one thing we're here to learn, and that is to what degree have we learned to love? To what degree have we learned to love and take care of each other and be good to each other and help each other and buoy each other up? That's very meaningful. Also, too, I had such a special experience in getting to say goodbye, not once, but twice. Once to my wife and once to my son. He was just a baby at the time. I've had other dreams where he's not a baby anymore. And that's an interesting scenario, too. I encountered him in dreams and other things where he's not the little baby anymore. Maybe we can address that in Q&A. But I got to say goodbye, and yet so many people don't. When Spencer called, I'm sure Addison's pain is he's back east at school. He didn't get a chance to say goodbye to his dad, unless he has some spiritual thing. But tell the people around you that you love them. Go home and hug the people that are close to you and kiss them and tell them you love them. And realize that it can be that fleeting. They can be gone in a heartbeat. Don't let the chance slip away that there's any regrets left, that there's anything left unsaid or undone, because I don't think people are as lucky as I got to be. And I don't mean that in arrogance. I was very lucky. I'm very grateful that happened. But I'm happy to take questions. I'm happy to talk about this. I told Bob, I said, I can't sensationalize it. I can't, diminish it. I'll just tell you what I experienced, tell you what happened. And that's really it in a nutshell. I would love to take questions.
Thank you so much for sharing this. It's just been wonderful. My question is that you were told why you needed to come back. I'm curious why you needed to come back. What answer
you got? Well, the overwhelming thing was my son Spencer. He could not be left orphaned. I mean, there was no way he was going to lose both his parents and his only sibling in one full swoop. However, that happens to other people. I mean, I'm not, you know, the overwhelming thing was he needed me here. And I, without getting too personal, Spencer, we came to find out, and I'm telling you, bless your heart, I didn't know this at the time. As he grew up, we found that there were some strange things about Spencer, and he suffers from what they call Asperger's syndrome. It's a high-functioning form of autism. He's a brilliant kid, straight-A student. He's become a talented musician. He's a bass player. To him, the bass is math. I mean, he'll sit and explain that if I pluck this string on a C note, it vibrates at that many times per second, and that creates this frequency, and that creates this tone, and that's why that girl over there is going to dance when I hit this one, you know. It's math to him. This is how their mind works. They call it the genius disease. See, he wrote a paper in high school that he said, I can express myself and hide behind the barrier of my guitar, and that's how. So overwhelmingly it was to be him. Cut that to a clear answer. I'm probably one of his best friends. You keep the reason I'm here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your story very much, your experience. I was wondering, when you described this hospital that you visited, was this on the other side that you were? It was on.
No, it was here. In fact, as I was in the hospital and wandered about the hospital, in reality, it was the same place. So my spirit, I suppose, was walking through the hospital here, getting back to my body. And I think it's odd because it wasn't spontaneous. I didn't go from the great place of light and love, heaven, right into my body. I found myself wandering around the hospital, and yet encountering people and feeling them on that level may have been the most pertinent of the experience, with the exception of the encounter with my son and the great being that stood behind me.
And you said that what you experienced in them, you could, their emotions, what they...
I seemed to know everything about them. I seemed to know them perfectly. It was the strangest thing. Even if I was just walking past them.
And the most important thing that we can do is to learn to love. So would it be fair to say that what we're here to do is to learn to harness those emotions, to feel the right emotion at any given time?
Yes. If I could walk life in the consciousness that I had at that moment, it would be amazing. Because everyone you would encounter, you would understand and love and know exactly how to help.
Did they have to revive you when you were in the hospital?
You know, I don't know that they had to revive me. I don't know that I was clinically dead. But there was so much travel. The accident was down by Parowan. Oddly enough, the first people on the scene were a husband and wife medical team that was on vacation. And they did some type of an emergency, something to try to get air into my lungs. They had oxygen in their trailer by some bizarre sequence. And again, this is all, you know, Mom, if you want to raise your hand and answer your question. But they were the first ones on the scene, and they were able to call and get people there. And they took me to Cedar City first, and air-flighted me from Cedar City to LDS. And then eventually transferred me to the University of Utah to, they were trying to save my leg. They did all kinds of weird leech therapy and everything else. But the infection was so bad, they were unable to save it.
When you said that you felt the words,
yeah,
I have had that experience, and that's all it is. You feel the words, and you interpret it into a statement. Mm-hmm. And so I totally believe you, and I know that it's the truth. If you can just give all of us, like you said, learn to love and look past, that right there told me that there was an afterlife. Even if I ever had any doubts, because I knew that I was being communicated with on a different frequency.
Yeah. The words, you felt them to your very core, and you understood them perfectly. And it seems within a second you can know volumes, and yet the hardest thing is trying to put that into words. Words are a terrible way to communicate. They're not, you know, how can you ever say how you feel? How can you ever say what you mean? I hope in the afterlife we have that ability to look at someone and they know. They just know. And it doesn't have to be put into a sentence. I can't even spell, so that was just a pleasure.
I was really inspired with your words when the doctor and the nurse came in to see you.
Yeah.
And you said that they were able to participate or be in the glory that you were in. So, you know, when you saw your wife in that place, was there anyone else around?
No.
So would you say that it was like yours and hers glory?
May have been. All I know is she was there and she was very close. So, you know, I've heard other near-death experiences where they've walked around and seen meadows and skies. It wasn't like that. I was in light and she was with me and everything was very close.
Did she appear more glorious to you, or did you witness, were you aware of that?
She appeared glorious to me, yes. You know, she did. I mean,
so they
angelic, but it was her. She was no different. It was her. She wasn't necessarily a transformed being that I didn't recognize, but she was glorious, and I knew at the scene that she was gone, so I knew I was encountering something that was beyond this world, but I think more from the way I felt than the way she appeared. Is that fair?
I just think it's wonderful how the nurse and doctor were able to witness the glory from this side that you and your wife shared.
It's interesting, I'm trying, you know, I don't know how much personal stuff to dump out. The nurse, and I don't even know her last name, I remember her first name was Rhonda, but she had gone through her third divorce at the time, and she said it was odd because she had poured her heart out to whoever she prayed to, asking, does love exist? Is it even real? And then she encountered this. And that was her side of the story. The doctor's side of the story was far more clinical. He's like, I've never seen anybody with your injuries. Can't understand it. Now, oddly enough, he's still a dear friend of mine. He has called and checked up. We have lunch, and he still just shakes his head. And now he teases me. He says, can't they get you a leg to help you walk better? You know, he's become a dear friend. So it was very profound to them. And I'm not going to speak for them or what they experienced or what they told me, but it was profound enough that her view of love had changed, and it was profound enough to him that he's continued to call. He would come see me. He would visit me at my brother's house. He came to my own house. We've remained close for, and it's been now, it was 97, so it's been 13 years.
Thank you.
What activities here on Earth seems to get you closest to that feeling of peace and joy that you experience on the other side?
That's a great question. Because I've sought that for 13 years. Now, it's odd, you know, nothing gets me close to that piece of dough. But the things I've found that tend to raise my level of consciousness, and here again, here's this words thing. What's the right word? Is it prayer or is it meditation? I mean, people have said prayer is when you talk to God. Meditation is when you listen for the answer. But I think meditating, sitting quiet, being still, and just letting the energy come. I have found that to be the most beneficial. I like good music. Sometimes that helps. But sometimes if I sit out on the patio and just shut everything out and just go to that deep, deep place inside myself, that's where I find it. Oddly enough, sometimes in doing that is when I've had these dreams or encounters of my deceased son again. And yet he was not a child. I had one encounter where he was a grown man. Whether it's real or not, I don't know. I've asked people, I was meditating, I dozed off, I had this, and they said, does it matter if it was real or not? If you experienced it, it's giving you joy and peace and more understanding, then what does it matter? But that's what I found, is I would probably classify it meditation, more listening than praying.
I also would like to thank you for being here. I have two questions. One of them was, you mentioned when you were embracing your son as the infant, and the personage behind you.
Yeah.
You mentioned it on one occasion as a single person, but you referred to it most of the time as they. Was there a different sense there, that there was more than one person? Or?
That I didn't know I said that. It could have been. My sense was it was one being, but the feeling was multiplied in magnitude. But it was one voice, it was one feeling. I believe it was one being. I don't know. I'm not sure how to answer that. However, having experienced what I did in the hospital and this, are any of us separate? Are any of us really separate from God or really separate from each other? So maybe they was appropriate even though I was subconsciously saying that. But the clear answer is, no, it felt like one being to me, one person.
And then the other one was, did you sense a difference or notice that there was a difference between perhaps an unresurrected being and a resurrected being?
Can't articulate that one either. However, when I held my infant son, which, and this is an odd thing to understand now, in my upbringing, I would have always thought, well, the spirit isn't really tangible. It's, you know, it's not necessarily tangible. When I held him here, I felt every structure of his body, everything. I don't believe he was resurrected at that point. I don't know what state we're in, but I know he was very tangible. Now, on a deeper level, as I've studied and read, I've understood that spirit is matter. Spirit is tangible. It's just finer. So maybe in being there, I was refined, able to feel that refined matter in a super sensory way that is even beyond what we experience here in mortality. But whether there was a difference, I don't know. I can't really answer that honestly because I don't know. And those are my three favorite words. I don't know. I don't know.
Okay, I have a few questions for you. So you guys bear with me. One is, did Spencer ever share with you that he had an experience?
Spencer said early on that he said that when he was in the back seat, that he said, I felt something hold me very tight. I felt arms come around me very tight. Now, the first people on the scene of the accident, bless their heart, I can't imagine the mess they encountered. But they removed Spencer from the car, and they put him on a blanket over away from the accident. He made a comment to them, something to the effect of, where's my mom? And they said, well, she's right over here. And he said, no, she's not. She's right here with me. Now, I spoke to him today. You know, I said, how are you going to comfort your friend? I said, obviously, you know, he's calling you because he knows you've lost a parent. And he's saying, how did you get through this? I said, have you ever felt those things? And he says, well, I have. I said, how did you get through it? He said, well, I just pretended they were still alive. But he said, I was just a little boy, so I don't know. But the only experiences he had shared was at the scene, having felt that someone held him very tight. He felt his mother's spirit was there with him. And then during the months that we were alone, he did wake up one day and tell me, I dreamed mom came and kissed me on the forehead. But he said it was a dream. I woke up and they were gone still, you know. But I think those dreams are gifts. I don't think they're make-believe. So.
Another question. You said that you were able to understand these people as you walked through the hospital, as if you were them.
Yeah.
Now, that implies to me that you might not have had a life review, but that you also had that same understanding of yourself.
Maybe so. It was a profound thing because I knew them, and it's interesting. You would encounter people, you'd say, wow, light, goodness, love. Then you would encounter someone, you'd say, wow, hate, grief, guilt. But all of a sudden you said, but I know why. I understand why.
And then you loved them.
And I loved them.
What is the difference between how you perceived yourself before the accident and the near-death experience and after?
Before, I was very driven. I mean, being athletic, driven in my career. I'm going to prove it. I'm going to win. I'm going to, you know, kick butt and take names type of a mentality. And
back on the ranch.
Yeah. And I think afterwards, you know, obviously I was humbled. I mean, not only physically, but emotionally humbled to realize, you know what, everybody can win. There doesn't have to be a winner and a loser. There doesn't have to be a competition. Our only competition is to what degree can we personally learn to love. That should be our competition and not I can love better than you can mentality.
One more, and I'll be through. Done research in near-death experiences for a long time. So when this question is very common amongst near-death experiencers, how were you able to tell your wife present, and how did she take it? And how, because that's the hardest thing, is do they believe you and do they really join in that part? And I don't know if she wants to.
I should let her address that question as well.
No, I'd love her to. Yes. I asked you if you believed him when he first told you, and how did you respond to it, and how has it affected you in your marriage?
Jeff and I met in a very interesting way. I'm not from Utah, and at the time was not of the predominant religion here. So I had moved here temporarily and did not really particularly like it. But I had encounters with his wife before we married. And so not only I did, but several other people did, some of our friends did as well, that we were supposed to be together. And so I've encountered his wife on numerous occasions over the years. There are many times I'll just go up to the cemetery and I'll sit and talk to her for hours. I mean, having Spencer have Asperger's has been difficult, but also I've been told I have survivor's guilt, even though I didn't know Cameron. But I have felt guilty over the years for surviving or for being alive, whereas they had the perfect family and the perfect life. And here I am. I still struggle with what is my purpose here and why was I sent here. So I, of course I believed him. I drag him to these kinds of things all the time. So it's really me that...
I'm usually listening.
...into this kind of stuff, so...
Well, I think Tanya sells herself short. If I can elaborate on that a little bit, I was so heartbroken. I was so bereaved. I didn't even date. I had a nanny that would help Spencer after school. I had family and friends that would help with laundry and whatever. And I was quite committed that I was just going to hunker down and get through life. And, you know, people would say, well, gosh, you ought to date. You ought to, you know. And I said, you know, I suppose if somebody gift-wrapped the woman I'm supposed to be with and delivered them on my porch, I'd pay attention, and they kind of gift-wrapped her and delivered her on the porch. And when I say they, I guess I'm referring to the same they I spoke of before. I don't know where or how it happened. I only knew that when I met Tanya, I had a super sensory experience which was beyond this earth, and it wasn't, I mean, she's a beautiful woman. People have super sensory experiences as soon as she walks in the room, but it wasn't like that. I had a knowing, I had a strange feeling, and I even went home that night and fell on my knees. I said, you know, dear Lord, I've lost my mind. I met this woman, I feel like I love her. How can that be? And the interesting thing, and I don't profess to have conversations with God on a regular basis, but on that occasion, he whispered to me and said, it's not your love you're feeling, it's my love for her that you're feeling. And it was, it was a whirlwind relationship. We dove into a marriage without even knowing each other, and it's been a very interesting ride, and yet here we are. And I love her dearly, and she's been... a strength to me, and I feel like sometimes she has a closer relationship with my deceased wife than I do. I think they team up on me and pick on me all the time. And I don't have a chance. But it's interesting, and a tribute to Tanya. To what degree can you love? I mean, when we knew it was serious and we made plans to marry, and you know, she was moving into my home, and I said, you know, you can remodel it. Obviously, you can take the pictures down, but let's start fresh. And Tanya said, no, that's Spencer's mom. You know, was your wife. So she's left pictures where Spencer can remember and honor his mother. And if we have time, this was an interesting story. I remember, and I hope I don't embarrass Tanya telling this story, trying to put a family together is a strange thing. And Tanya deserves a crown, beyond a crown, for coming into my situation and moving in, trying to... she was a single... successful career girl. She wasn't going to get married and wasn't have kids either. And all of a sudden she had a one-legged husband and an Asperger's son and took all this on. And I remember laying in bed one night and Spencer wanted to sleep out on the trampoline, you know, and it was kind of outside the window and Tanya had gone to lay on the trampoline with him. And I hope I can remember this. I heard a conversation that went something like this. Spencer, you were such a special kid that me and your mom made a deal. She was going to get you for the first half of your boyhood, and then I would get you for your second half. You're a lucky boy because you have two moms. You've got one in heaven that loves you very much and can do for you what I could never do, but you've got me here as well. So you're lucky. You're a lucky boy. And of course, you know, I laid in the bed and wept and thought, it's a blessing, right? It's a gift.
This is hard because I'm so overcome with spirit right now, but I've been neighbors with Tanya and Jeff for a while and lucky enough to become friends with them. And this is kind of a little miracle. Last night, I was with my son, one of my sons who just happened to be, I just happened to mention I was coming here tonight, and there was another lady in the car with us. I just described it for just a second because I knew that they didn't know you.
the lady looked at me and she said, "Is this Jeff Olson by any chance?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Your son Matt and I stay at Tamara's funeral. And so he's very anxious to meet you."
"Well, I'd be happy to meet him. Thanks, Deborah. That's nice. We got a question down here and one over there." And
you mentioned about how you said something about you felt they were communicating with you, that she wasn't taken from you. Can you expound on that?
It was my son. As I held him, and he was sleeping, he was asleep in my arms. He didn't communicate. It was the being behind me, which I will classify as God or Jesus. It was a magnificent male being. They communicated to me that they wanted to provide me the opportunity to make a choice about this, to choose. They didn't want me to feel like they were taken, but to feel like I could give it up. I could give them, and that would be consecrated to me in some way that would bring peace and joy rather than the pain of feeling that they've been taken away. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
You have a responsibility with your child and your new wife. Have you feeling of a further mission concerning other people?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm just a farm kid from Charleston. I don't know. I mean, but yes, we all have a responsibility. We have a collective responsibility. The responsibility is not only to love and take care of each other, but it's to heal each other, to heal the world, to heal the earth, to heal some way all the wrongs that not only we've done personally, but that we've collectively done. And I don't feel that I have some particular calling of any kind that's any different than anyone else has. I used to contemplate that. Gosh, why was I spared? Is there some magnificent thing I have to do? And, you know, it might be, you know, you see that down and out homeless guy on the street and you give him a quarter and give him a hug and maybe that's what you were spared for. That might be the glorious calling that you have to do. I don't know, but I don't have a sense that, okay, I'm spared or special. It's quite the opposite. I feel like, you know what, I'm one of the masses. In some way I can use what I know to help raise the level of awareness or vibration or love or consciousness or spirituality of any given soul, then that would be my mission, I suppose.
Do you have any sense at all of how much longer you might live here with the rest of us?
You know, I don't. It's funny you say that, because I say I have no fear of death, and my wife gets angry when I say this, but it's like, you know what, I quite look forward to it. I've got young sons too. We've adopted two boys, and I'm raising a young family, and I need to be here for them, but I have no sense. No, and here I get really personal. My biggest fear is I won't die. My biggest fear is I've already done that once, and I'll be here for a very long time. And you know, and there still is a lot of pain associated. I mean, you know, this knee's a wreck, and I get trouble with the stump, and my back and hips are messed up, and there's a lot of pain and things associated with it. I don't take medication. I'm not interested in medicating the pain, and I, you know, I've got a pretty high tolerance, but no, there's times it's like, you know what, let's be done and get on with things, and then I think, no, you know, I've got these young children and I'm not here a long time, but if I had a very quiet whispering, it's, I'm not going to get to die, I'm just going to have to be here for a very, very, very long time, which is a joy. That's the other thing too. I mean, when I say no fear of death, no fear of life either. I mean, gosh, let's live it. And you know, I think, and this is my personal insight, but I think we've always existed. I think we're eternal beings. We, you know, we don't have a beginning and an end. We've always been, and I think that we're always going to be as we walk this earth. Let's get our money's worth. You know, let's get our money's worth and learn and grow and develop into what we were created to be, which I think is magnificent. So.
And give our money's worth.
Yes, give our money's worth, absolutely.
Thanks, Jeff and Tanya, for coming and sharing. I know a couple that kind of half-heartedly joke about this, but the wife says that if she precedes the husband, she'll kill him if he remarries.
I've heard that before.
I mean, has that kind of a disposition, and I don't know, maybe she's serious about it, but seems to be that way disposed, very possessive and almost impossible to embrace another woman or another person in the same way without feeling threatened or like they lose everything that's meaningful to them. So perhaps this is a question for Tanya. Because to me, what I've heard here tonight is a real translation of that infinite love into this finite, corrupt world. And that's a real gift you're sharing. I want to hear a little more about that.
You know, I can share one piece, and I'll let Tanya address that. And this is very personal, and I hope this doesn't sensationalize things. My first wife, the morning before we left for St. George, woke up, and she said, "I had the strangest dream last night." You know, and I said, "What was that?" She said, I dreamed you were marrying somebody else. And I said, "Oh, great. You know, now I'm going to be in trouble all weekend long." You know, and she said, "No, it was really bizarre because," she said, "somehow I was okay with it." Now, given the events that transpired, that's kind of amazing. You know, I mean, she was human, I was human. I mean, people are jealous. They have jealousies. They have fears. There's only two things. There's either love or there's fear, and jealousy is born of fear, right? She had what I classify must have been a premonition, and yet, when I fell in love with Tanya, my soul was torn. How can I love again? How can I do this? And I spent plenty of time up at the cemetery in the grave site as well, and I remember throwing myself on my deceased wife's grave saying, "What am I going to do? I'm falling in love with someone else." And there was comfort and peace. I didn't have any transforming experience, but there was comfort and peace that was okay. And that unconditional love is what it's all about. So, Tanya, you can speak to that if you'd like.
Well, I'm not the type of person that gets jealous, and I am more of an accepting, loving person, especially as far as camera goes. And I'll just relay this one little incident that happened shortly after we were married. In fact, it was for your 60th birthday. We were putting together a scrapbook for you.
And she was 50. No,
sorry, 50.
No.
And Jeff was encouraging me to have Spencer help me with the scrapbook. Well, an 8-year-old boy has absolutely no interest in scrapbooking. And so we argued about this. I mean, this was one of our very first fights as a married couple. He stormed off, left for work. You know, Spencer was at school, and I was sitting at the dining room table and just stewing over it and just so angry. And how stupid was Jeff? No kid wants to sit in scrapbook, and I'll do this myself. And I was just going over this in my mind, and I stood up really fast to walk into the next room, and Tamara had been behind me, and I walked through her spirit, and as Jeff explained, in an instant, I felt volumes. I felt her profound sadness at us fighting for one thing, yet her intense love for us, and just, it was everything combined in one. I smelled her. I felt her. I smelled her. I knew her, and it has always been that way for some reason. I've never met her. I don't know her. But she's as much as part of our family as anyone else is. So
I know that we have to, that you found through this experience the value and the importance of love, and that's something we have to learn in this life, loving unconditionally. But I wonder, do you feel a need that you have to constantly be in the service all the time of your fellow man, or is it, you know, are we okay just being a grandma and being a dad and being a mom, or?
You know, and that's a great question. The greatest thing we can be is a grandma and mom and a dad. I mean, that is in the service of the greatest of all. And no, I mean, I go home and I go to bed and turn on the TV, and I still walk by people in the street that might need help. Like I say, it doesn't transform me into anything inhuman or beyond what we are here. I find great joy when I do serve in some way, but sometimes it's just reading to your boys or doing things that you do, and I think those are the greatest acts of service that we can do. Those are the greatest things.
And I was just going to say, answer his question for you,
your greatest calling that you have right now, and you just kind of answered that yourself as your two adopted kids.
That's fine.
You are doing something great and fantastic. You were left behind for that reason.
Yeah, and they found us in a strange way.
I hope you figured that out, because that's what I'm getting out of this. That is your reason you're here. Yeah. You have three children now.
That's right.
And they're very important.
And they came to us in an interesting way, too. But that's the greatest thing we can do, is be their dad, you know.
How old are they?
My oldest turned 11 today. It's his birth. The oldest of the two young adult ones. He turned 11 today, and the other one is 9. He'll be 10 in August. And we adopted them as a pair. They're brothers. Same birth mother, different father. But the birth mother had Zachary. He was just over a year old, and she was pregnant with Aiden. That's a whole other story. We hadn't even formally applied for adoption. They just came whisking into our lives almost the way Tanya did. And if there's been a lot of strange things have happened since my experience, and they're cosmic and they're spiritual and they're strange and almost too hard to believe. But anyway, that is my greatest calling. I love being a dad. When Bob said, "How shall I introduce you?" I said, "Just tell him I'm a father of three and married to a lovely woman, and That's what's important. None of the other matters."
I'm going to take you back just for a moment when you were there and you were holding your son and this intense loving spirit come up behind you and you were sure it was the Savior. I was wondering if he introduced himself as the Savior. And the reason I'm asking is because I'm reading a book right now that has a lot of research has gone in about NDAs around the world and their near-death experiences for the Buddhists. They swear that it is Buddha.
Right.
For Muslims, it's Muhammad. For Hindus, it's what? And for Christians, it's Christ. But he said in the book that they perceive it as self, and possibly it's them or an emissary, but they never address themselves or introduce themselves as such. They are perceived. Did he introduce himself as the
self? No, he did not introduce himself. I felt the presence. And whether it was the father or the son, I don't know. It was an immense male presence. But there was no introduction. Nobody said, "This is who I am." I just felt it, and I did. I perceived, oh my goodness. But I didn't even turn around. I felt that it was not given me to turn around and look on them, that I just would stand and listen and feel their glory. But no introduction.
Okay, I hope I can articulate what I'm trying to say here. You mentioned that, just a statement that you made, it says, "Are any of us really separate?" was a statement that you made. And then you talked about how you felt like you knew these people. And then when you were talking about Tanya, you talked about how you felt this immense love for her when you were kneeling down and praying about it, that it came back to you that it wasn't your love, it was God's love. So, do you think then that we love through God? Do we love with God? Do we remember who we once loved and love them again because we're remembering? Is it a connection that way? How do you see that connection?
Wow. Yes. Yes, we love through God. Yes, we love on our own. This is my perception. I'm no expert, even though I've had this experience. I'll never profess to know anything, really. In fact, the more I think I know, the more I realize I don't know anything. But I think that we know God's love. I think we are God's love. We came from that. It's who we are at the core of our beings. I was about to say we're supposed to learn to love like He does. I'll rephrase that and say we're supposed to remember to love like He does. Remember who we are. Remember who He is. And remember our connection to Him and to everyone around us, that we are one. So I think we love like Him, through Him, but we are Him, or we are offspring or parts of Him. That's the best answer I can give, I guess. You guys have tough questions.
I'd like to know your experience in sharing this and in re-presencing yourself, contemplating sharing it. What has the impact been on you?
That's a kind question. I told Tanya before we came, I said, I'm actually quite calm. I usually get very nervous, and I'm in front of people on a regular basis, but I still get nervous, if I have to get in front of people. I said, oddly enough, I'm quite calm, and I haven't shared this publicly. I've shared it with family and small, church people groups or things like that, but in readdressing it, I've been quite calm. Now, the interesting thing, I can't remember all the details of the hospital. I can't remember the details of the crash. But the experiences I had, which would be classified, I suppose, as near death or on the other side or out of body, the memory of those and the details will never go away. They're as if they were yesterday. The rest of it is like, oh, I can't remember how, you know, what happened. But it's been a joyous experience. I mean, if I'm standing here right now, it's like, gosh, I'm glad I did this. I'm glad if it helps someone. I'm glad that even with the phone call today to my son, I could say, you know what? There is a life after. There is love and light there. Tell him that, yes, it's going to hurt for a long time, but there's something much better and brighter around the corner and probably in a blink of an eye. Life is so short, so.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jeff.